Taliban. In his hotel rooms, as the multicolored lights of Dubai blinked outside, the Saudi revealed that in recent days, he had received a letter and two telephone calls from well-known Taliban representatives who said they were in direct contact with Mullah Muhammad Omar. They wanted to convey privately to Saudi Arabia and the United States that Omar had appointed a new exclusive representative for political negotiations. The man's name was Tayyib Aga. He was visiting Jeddah, the Saudi city on the Red Sea. "There is one channel for talking to the Taliban," the Saudi explained to Reuben, "and it should be protected and strengthened." He said that he had told the Taliban that the Americans were ready to stay in Afghanistan for 20 years, if that's what it took. Yet there were nonetheless possibilities for negotiation to separate the Taliban from Al-Qaeda and coax them into power-sharing and Afghan politics. "The U.S. does not want to lose, and the Taliban do not want to lose," the Saudi interlocutor observed. "Both want a way out in which they do not lose." He said he was about to fly to Morocco, where Prince Mukreen maintained a summer palace, to tell the spy chief about this new development. As for next steps, he said, the Saudis were wary about becoming too exposed in a peace negotiation with the Taliban. The kingdom considered itself at war with Al-Qaeda, which had staged terrorist attacks inside Saudi Arabia. "The royal family," he went on, "wanted a letter plus a voice cassette from Mullah Omar, making clear that the Taliban do not support terrorist activities anywhere in the world and that the Taliban have had no contact with Al-Qaeda for the past 7 years." That was a tall order. Yet Saudi Arabia had been damaged by allegations that its royal family officially supported Al-Qaeda and other terrorists. The kingdom would not broker talks with the Taliban if there was any risk that it would be accused again of such complicity. How could this anxiety be squared with Mansour's acknowledgement that Tayyib Aga, an official Taliban envoy, in his account, was resting comfortably in Jeddah? Officially, the royal family took the position that, as custodians of the two holy mosques in Mecca and Medina, they could not refuse entry to any Muslim seeking pilgrimage. Unofficially, the policy allowed the kingdom to maintain contacts with Islamist groups to persuade them that Saudi Arabia meant them no harm. Reuben flew back to France. He did not know it then, but his meeting had inaugurated what would become a 4-year project of secret diplomacy between the United States and the Taliban. Aimed at finding a political settlement to end the Afghan war, or at least reduce its violence. The project would ultimately draw in President Obama, who would invest long hours of personal effort. Not since Vietnam had the United States undertaken a comparable effort to negotiate with its enemy secretly while in the midst of war. On August 11th, Reuben wrote privately to Holbrooke that Tayyib Aga is the chief of finance for the Taliban leadership Shura and frequently travels to Saudi Arabia to collect funds from individuals, businesses, and charities. The United States faced a dilemma. It seemed apparent that the same Taliban envoy who traveled outside Afghanistan and Pakistan to raise funds for the movement was also a potential channel for diplomatic contact. If they sanctioned him for fundraising, they would lose him as a potential point of entry to Taliban leadership. A few days later, at Holbrooke's invitation, Reuben penned a second memo formally urging that any sanctions decision be postponed while they assess this opening for engagement with Mullah Omar. Holbrooke did not share Reuben's reports widely, if at all, in Washington. If Holbrooke surfaced the news about Mullah Muhammad Omar's appointment of Tayyib Aga as a special envoy, he risked further isolation. Reuben had been reporting to Holbrooke periodically about all sorts of putative channels to the Taliban leadership. He was confident about Tayyib Aga's probable legitimacy, but the overall picture of who represented whom and what Mullah Omar or the rest of the Taliban's leadership wanted in possible talks was confusing. The best course was to wait and probe. Holbrook warned Reuben to be discreet and patient. Proposing talks for a political settlement with the Taliban was much too incendiary an idea for the Obama administration to digest right now. Remember, Holbrook told his advisor, your problem is not with the Taliban. Your problem is with Dennis McDonough and the CIA. On Saturday, September 12th, at a meeting at the Brookings Institution, Holbrook disclosed that the CIA had recently completed its latest update of the district assessments. A superficial examination of the colored maps showed that more of the country was under Taliban control than under government control, Holbrook remarked. But a deeper look, accounting for areas that were contested or controlled by neither side, presented a less dire picture of the war. There was time to turn this conflict around. Yet it frustrated Holbrook that so much analysis of the war looked at the Taliban from the outside in. Where was Mullah Omar? With whom was he consulting about Taliban strategy? What did diverse members of the Quetta Shura think about the Obama administration's escalation of the war? Recent intelligence reporting suggested that Mullah Omar had threatened to kill anyone who tried to reach out for political talks with the United States without his personal authorization, Holbrook disclosed. If this was accurate, what was Mullah Omar worried about? Were splits emerging in the leadership? On Monday, September 14th, Holbrook met with Steve Kappas of the CIA to discuss how the agency could probe the Taliban's political outlook more deeply. Until now, the CIA had been given no formal tasking from the White House to collect intelligence on political debates within the Taliban leadership or how the movement might assess peace negotiations with Karzai, Saudi Arabia, or the Obama administration. It seemed evident from military reporting that the Taliban had suffered very heavy casualties in Kandahar and Helmand after 2006, but the impact of these losses on the movement was a mystery. The CIA's mission in Afghanistan still prioritized counterterrorism and Karzai watching. Holbrook and Kappas agreed that the agency would now undertake more collection on the Quetta Shura and political views within the Taliban leadership. It was not a brand new tasking, but Kappas wanted to be fair to Holbrook, and the CIA was in business to take deeper looks at such difficult targets. The CIA responded that autumn by circulating intelligence reports derived from secret interviews its field officers conducted with Taliban leaders, current and former. Yet even as this intelligence seeped into the American system, the possibility of direct talks with the Taliban leadership was not on the table during the long review of Afghan war strategy that Obama oversaw in the Situation Room that autumn of 2009. General Petraeus, extrapolating from his successes in Iraq turning Sunni tribesmen against al-Qaeda, advocated for trying to induce battlefield defections of Taliban commanders and soldiers, a program he called reintegration of enemy fighters, from the bottom up, as opposed to reconciliation with Taliban leaders, from the top down, which might come later. Petraeus did not actually believe Holbrook's vision of reconciliation was viable because there was no way for the United States to threaten the Taliban leadership, who felt safe in Pakistan. Without such coercion, why would the Taliban negotiate seriously? Drawing on Bush administration policy, the White House did seek to give space for Afghans to talk among themselves about peace. The president's West Point speech therefore contained only a single sentence about seeking accommodation with the Taliban. We will support efforts by the Afghan government to open the door to those Taliban who abandon violence and respect the human rights of their fellow citizens. In the absence of presidential support, Holbrook used Barney Rubin as the forward probe of his own diplomatic operation, to identify and test Taliban negotiating channels. Rubin was an unconventional choice. Rubin had never worked in government before Holbrook drafted him, never mind on top-secret, compartmented national security matters. Yet Doug Loot, the general who ran Afghanistan and Pakistan policy at the National Security Council, remained friendly with Reuben and protected him. As Reuben provoked the national security bureaucracy with his travel and discussions with Taliban interlocutors, Loot made sure the White House and the Pentagon did not try to cut him off. On December 11, 2009, 10 days after Obama's West Point speech, Reuben arrived at the Foreign Office in London to talk about his project with British counterparts. A Taliban specialist from MI6 joined the discussion. "Change is in the air," the British intelligence officer reported. "A substantial part of the Taliban senior leadership is interested in reconciliation talks." Their motives were not benign. They wanted to divide the NATO coalition in Afghanistan by demonstrating willingness to compromise. Yet it remained hard to read who within the Taliban high command was behind these gestures or where Mullah Muhammad Omar stood. In a separate meeting during this period, a senior Foreign Office official asked an MI6 counterpart, "If we wanted to pass a private message to Mullah Omar, do we have a reliable channel to do so?" "Not really," was the reply. Foreign Secretary David Miliband sought to push the Obama administration toward negotiations. Yet Prime Minister Gordon Brown's government did not think having Barney Rubin fly around the Gulf looking for Taliban intermediaries was the best approach. Drawing on experience in Northern Ireland and elsewhere, the British argued that the CIA should open up initial direct contacts with the Taliban to probe, collect insights, and build confidence in the event that serious negotiations evolved. The CIA had cachet. Enemies of the United States often preferred to deal with the spy service directly. Also, Langley managed the American relationship with ISI, the Taliban's historical patron. As Steve Kappas, the CIA's deputy director, put it during one discussion, "You don't think the ISI doesn't have the Taliban penetrated and will find out everything that is going on anyway? Why not collaborate with ISI and guard our interests at the same time?" Reuben and other interlocutors heard repeatedly from Taliban leaders that they wanted to speak directly to the United States, free from ISI interference. Yet it was possible that Kappas was correct about the penetration issue. The Taliban could not travel easily outside Pakistan without passports ISI approved, unless they resorted to forged documents. Holbrook, however, didn't want to lose control of any talks that might lead to negotiations to end the Afghan war. That was his turf, his potential legacy. He merely wanted the CIA to collect intelligence about the Taliban's leadership and internal politics. He preferred Reuben, whom he could control, more or less, and he feared that the CIA had become imprisoned intellectually about Afghanistan by wartime and counterterrorism dogma. After the new year, Reuben flew to Saudi Arabia, where he met Holbrooke in Riyadh, the capital. Prince Mukreen received them in his small and dark office at the General Intelligence Department. He introduced them to a general who had worked for Prince Turki bin Faisal, the Saudi intelligence chief during the anti-Soviet war of the 1980s. "The Taliban is still controlled by Pakistan," the general said. "Some Taliban leaders wanted to break free of Pakistan, but they were weak and would need support to act independently. Also, if the United States and Saudi Arabia negotiated with the Quetta Shura, they would have to reassure Pakistan that any settlement of the war would not harm its interests. Otherwise, the ISI would surely act as spoilers." Mukreen seemed hesitant to proceed. "He won't lift a finger," Holbrooke complained. The Saudis seemed reluctant to become entangled in the triangle among the United States, Hamid Karzai, and the ISI. They needed good relations with the ISI for their own reasons. Pakistan had nuclear know-how and infantry muscle that the kingdom might require in future crises. The inertia was typical of Saudi statecraft. The kingdom had high-level contacts across the Muslim world. It had wealth to buy influence, but its octogenarian royal family rarely took bold risks and lacked capacity to follow through. King Abdullah, Mukreen's boss, was then 85 years old. They traveled next to Abu Dhabi, where Holbrooke had convened a conference of special representatives to Afghanistan from governments worldwide, his mini United Nations of counterparts. The plenary, hosted by the Foreign Ministry of the United Arab Emirates, was largely ceremonial, designed to signal unity about Afghanistan to weary publics in Europe and Asia. Bernd Mutzelberg, the German representative, asked for a private audience with Holbrooke. When they were alone, Mutzelberg disclosed that 2 months earlier, while visiting Kabul, he had met with Mullah Zaif, the former Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, a founder of the movement, and later a prisoner at Guantanamo. After his release, Zaif had settled in Kabul. Zaif asked Mutzelberg if he would sound out the possibility of direct contact between Germany and the Taliban leadership. Mutzelberg had consulted with Hamid Karzai, who encouraged him to go ahead. So the envoy flew to Dubai to meet a man he now described as the head of the political commission of the Quetta Shura. They had talked twice. Mutzelberg had some trouble remembering the Taliban envoy's name, but said that he had once served as number two in the Taliban embassy in Islamabad, and also as Mullah Muhammad Omar's private secretary. Soon it became clear that the negotiator was Tayyib Aga, the same representative identified to Reuben the previous summer. What did the Taliban want? The paramount issue, Mutzelberg said, was for the Taliban to find some sort of independence from ISI, as well as relief from international sanctions and blacklists. Once free to negotiate without ISI coercion, the Taliban and NATO could try to build mutual confidence. Pakistan is playing its own games, trying to manipulate the Taliban, the German said. Taliban leaders and their families depended on ISI for identity cards, subsidies, and the right to live freely and earn a living. They wanted to negotiate directly with the Obama administration, not through ISI. Again, Holbrooke kept this startling disclosure largely to himself. Tayyib Aga's bona fides remained uncertain. When Holbrooke did start to introduce what he had learned from the Germans to colleagues in Washington, he said that Tayyip Aga's outreach merely represented a thread of contact with the Taliban high command. There were other threads, such as Zaif and separate Taliban contacts the Karzai family had developed without American involvement. The prudent course was to pull on each thread to discover what might be promising. Meanwhile, Holbrooke promoted Reuben's role within the administration. At ISAF headquarters in Kabul, a few days after the meeting with Mutzelberg, Holbrooke enthusiastically introduced the professor as a one-man CIA. This did even less than his Trotsky-eyed beard to endear Reuben to Langley or the Pentagon. On January 22, 2010, Doug Lute convened a National Security Council subgroup meeting to talk about talking to the Taliban. Present were Deputy National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, Reuben, Holbrooke, the Pentagon's Michelle Flournoy, Marine General James Cartwright, who was the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, White House Counterterrorism Czar John Brennan, and Chris Wood, the former Kabul Station Chief. Wood had lately been sent by the CIA to the office of the Director of National Intelligence to work on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Lute asked Holbrooke to open the discussion. Any negotiation would be tougher than Vietnam or Bosnia, Holbrooke said, because the Afghan war had so many actors. They were at the beginning of the beginning, he estimated. There is no secret negotiation with the Taliban, he said, in case they feared otherwise. They reviewed the policy on Taliban talks they had inherited from the Bush administration. It dated to 2004, when Zalmay Khalilzad had worked successfully with Karzai to bring some former Taliban ministers and diplomats into Kabul from Pakistan as defectors. The Bush administration policy, which had been revised in 2007, concerned what the United States thought it was acceptable for the Karzai government to do by itself when it talked to the enemy. It did not contemplate direct U.S. talks with the Taliban. The policy's main provision was a blacklist of 31 names. These were senior Taliban leaders that Karzai should not talk with under any circumstances, at least according to the United States. Mullah Muhammad Omar was at the top of the list. Several Haqqanis were listed, as were Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and some of his commanders. Tayyip Aga was also banned. He was described as a former aide to Mullah Omar, who continues as an aide to Omar. Lute asked one of his deputies, Jeff Hayes, a Defense Intelligence Agency analyst on loan to the White House, to review the bidding and see how they should handle the blacklist if serious talks now developed through Tayyip Aga or otherwise. In Hamid Karzai's growing alienation from the Obama administration, Generals Kayani and Pasha saw an opening for Pakistan. NATO governments had strong intercept coverage of at least some of the telephones Kayani and Pasha used. After Obama's West Point speech, the eavesdroppers heard Kayani express fears that a U.S. pullout would leave Pakistan vulnerable to more domestic violence, as Afghanistan fell into chaos again. The Army chief decided to see if he might lessen this risk by persuading Karzai to reach a political deal with Pakistan that might cut out the United States, at least partially. That winter, Pasha sent messages to the Arg Palace to indicate that Pakistan wanted to break the ice about a new alignment between Karzai and Pakistan. The Afghan president summoned Amrullah Saleh. "I want to invest in peace," Karzai told him. "I want to invest in friendship in Pakistan." Karzai invited Pasha to Kabul, unannounced, on January 18, 2010. Karzai did not mention the visit to Saleh until Pasha was already at the Arg Palace. As it happened, that day, the sounds of gunfire and grenade explosions had Kabul in a panic. As the ISI chief settled in at the palace, small squads of Taliban raiders attacked the central bank near the palace, as well as a hotel and a cinema. The timing was apparently coincidental. Karzai summoned Saleh, who was helping to direct the day's counterattack. Saleh greeted the ISI chief and provided a situation report. Karzai then asked him to leave the room. The implication was unsubtle. "I don't trust my spy chief, and neither do you, General Pasha, so let us talk without him. You are more independent of the U.S. now that you have been re-elected," the ISI chief told Karzai. "Pakistan," Pasha emphasized, was pleased to hear Karzai talk publicly from time to time about a broad-based, inclusive government in Afghanistan, one that might accommodate elements of the Taliban. The United States was on its way out, even as its forces flowed in for their temporary surge. Pakistan and Afghanistan could shape the region's future separately, without the burdens of American interference or hubris. Pasha invited Karzai to Islamabad for deeper talks with Kayani. As the conversation went on, Saleh waited in a reception area. Explosions echoed in the distance. He worked his cell phone as Afghan counterterrorism police tracked down and eventually subdued the Taliban attackers, who had disguised themselves in Afghan police uniforms. Karzai and Pasha emerged. The president asked Saleh to escort Pasha to the airport safely. "Do you have any leads as to who is doing this?" Pasha asked him in their sport utility vehicle as they wove toward Kabul International. "Yes, if you want, I can share with you. The attack is not finished, Mr. Director. The people inside the bank are communicating with a number in Pakistan. They are taking instructions. Right now, while you are with me. Brother, give it to me, Pasha said. Saleh wrote down the number. I will get back to you, Pasha promised. A week later, according to an Afghan account of the episode, Pasha called Saleh to report that he was right, but that, after the attack, the number was switched off and there was nothing more to be done. According to a Pakistani version of the same episode, the army followed up on the number, arrested 7 Afghans, and handed them over to NDS without publicity, only to have Saleh go public with a statement that he had proof the whole thing had been an ISI operation. The Pakistanis swallowed their frustration, according to this account, and the Pakistani security services concluded that Saleh was more interested in anti-Pakistan propaganda than cooperation. Toward the Americans, on the subject of talking to the Taliban about peace, Pasha adopted a posture of passive aggression. That winter, he summoned a Pakistani journalist and told him that Obama's surge into Afghanistan would inevitably fail. There were not enough Pashtuns in the Afghan army and police. The Taliban were popular and had the moral high ground as resistors to occupation, he went on. He denied outright that his service was supporting the Quetta Shura or the Haqqani network, yet indicated that only Pakistan could deliver the Taliban away from war and into politics. Not the Saudis, not the Americans on their own. ISI did not regard a Kabul government controlled by the Taliban as the only acceptable outcome, Pasha said. No, no, not at all. Our national interests have to be protected. That is our main concern. Pasha's message was clearly intended to reach the Obama administration, to signal that ISI was indispensable to any negotiation, and that it did not seek a maximalist outcome. The morning after Pasha departed Kabul, Karzai summoned Saleh to breakfast. The Afghan spy chief did not know what had gone on between the president and the ISI director in his absence. He was insulted by the exclusion, but he tried to be cordial. "Mr. President," he said, "whatever your purpose in pushing me out of the meeting, in my opinion, it didn't give a good signal to the Pakistanis. It showed ISI that the Afghan government lacked unity, that there was friction at the highest levels." Karzai said he wanted to accept the invitation to meet with Kayani and Pasha again in Islamabad to advance the discussions. He assured Saleh that he would participate fully. In fact, Karzai would again exclude Saleh from some meetings with Pasha, which fueled Saleh's suspicion that Karzai was discussing removing him or making other compromises for the sake of improved relations between the two countries. They flew to the Pakistani capital on March 11th. Karzai met with his civilian counterparts, President Asif Zardari and Prime Minister Yousaf Gilani. At the Serena Hotel, a 14-acre compound of gardens with touches of Islamic architecture, Karzai met with Kayani and Pasha in a VIP suite. As promised, this time, Saleh was there. Kayani's message was, "Talk to us, not the Americans. If there was to be peace, it had to come through Pakistan. The door is open. The support of ISI is essential to any workable resolution of the war," Kayani emphasized. If they were going to talk about a new relationship, Saleh said, they had to be honest about what Pakistan was trying to achieve. "Mr. Kayani, please don't tell me you are not supporting the Taliban," Saleh ventured. "Please tell me why you are supporting the Taliban. What is it that they do for Pakistan that we do not do?" Kayani demurred. Saleh pressed the point several times. Finally, Kayani said, addressing Karzai, "Mr. President, if you want us to trust you, let us create a strategic framework for our relationship to define it." They agreed to move forward. "Will the Northern Alliance comply if you agree with us?" Kayani asked. Karzai turned to Saleh, putting him on the spot. "Mr. President, I am not Northern Alliance," Saleh said. "I'm serving you. And I tell my Pakistani brothers, there is no Northern Alliance. It will be Pakistani pressure that will recreate the Northern Alliance. It doesn't exist now. And if it does, it is entirely in support of Karzai as the legitimate president of Afghanistan. President Karzai is representing Afghanistan." The heart of Kayani's offer to Karzai was, "We can help you sort out the insurgency. We can turn it off," as a NATO diplomat briefed on the discussion soon after described it. In exchange, Pakistan would expect Karzai to end, that was the word Kayani used, according to these accounts, Indian influence in Afghanistan. How would Kayani define the end of India's presence? As the clandestine contacts between ISI and the Arg Palace evolved in 2010, reportedly including face-to-face meetings and encrypted digital messages, Kayani and Pasha pressed to be provided a detailed map of the Indian footprint in Afghanistan, lists of companies, contracts, and personnel. They pressed for access to the Afghan National Army, through the Pakistani military attaché in Kabul, to understand the army's development and leading personalities. They proposed training dozens of Afghan army officers in Islamabad, which would create a channel of long-term influence. They sought an end to public rhetoric from Afghanistan bashing Pakistan. In exchange, the Pakistanis dangled the possibility of peace in Kabul, negotiations on strategic issues such as water and borders, and delivering the Taliban to a political settlement that might include Karzai continuing. Kayani and Pasha were particularly aggravated that NDS was protecting armed Baluch separatists from the Bugti tribe, who were fighting the Pakistan army in Pakistan's Baluchistan province. One Bugti leader lived in a safe house on Street 13 in Kabul under NDS protection. Baluch fighters trained in Kandahar, Kayani and Pasha reported, citing intelligence collected in part by the Pakistani embassy in Kabul. Pakistani diplomats lived near the Kabul safe house and documented the Bugti leader's takeout orders from a local Lebanese taverna. The man was wanted for terrorism in Pakistan, yet he was enjoying kebab and shelter with NDS connivance, the Pakistanis claimed. Karzai should make sure that India's diplomatic, business, and humanitarian projects around Afghanistan did not become covert launching pads for destabilizing Pakistan. It seemed to them obvious that Afghanistan remained an essential aspect of India's strategy of containing Pakistan. With its booming economy and expanding defense budget, India was a kind of irreversible tide gathering influence in the region, including in Afghanistan. The Pakistanis saw India's spy service, the Research and Analysis Wing, or RAW, behind every rock, Indian officials complained. True, this was unfair. India carried out reconstruction and humanitarian projects in Afghanistan in the same way many other countries did. There were about 4,000 Indians in the country, but more than half of those were cooks and maintenance workers on NATO bases who were recruited from labor contractors in the Persian Gulf. They never left the bases. Yet, in fairness to Kayani, it was not as if RAW had dropped out of covert action specifically designed to undermine Pakistani stability. After the meeting at the Serena in Islamabad, Pasha and Saleh met secretly several times, in Ankara and elsewhere, to work on a draft strategic framework agreement. Pasha flew back to Kabul and met privately again with Karzai. Yet Karzai seemed to change his mind from day to day about whether he should pursue a separate peace with the ISI. He seemed rattled. Some of his aides advised him that Pasha and Kayani were right. Afghanistan would be better off dealing with Pakistan directly. "Don't you think there's too much Indian influence on Afghanistan?" Karzai asked several American visitors privately in the weeks after his trip to Islamabad. "My first choice would be a strategic alignment of the United States, India, and Afghanistan against Pakistan. Karzai explained to a senior American official. But I don't think that's what you're pursuing. I think you're cutting a separate deal with Pakistan, leaving me out. If that's the case, I need to cut my own deal with Pakistan. It's actually a lot less conspiratorial than you think, the American tried to argue. We're trying to forge a moderate, balanced policy among all these parties. But Karzai wasn't buying it. He was clearly toying with a deal with ISI, but he also recognized that it would be a great risk. In Washington, Barnett Rubin warned Holbrook that it was not just Karzai who had lost confidence in American strategy. The United States, he wrote on March 18th, is in danger once again of allowing its policy in the region to be manipulated by the deception of the Pakistan military, which would result in granting Pakistan an outsized role in Afghanistan. The perception that the United States is positioning itself for a deal with Pakistan at Afghanistan's expense is widespread in the Afghan political elite and is not confined to President Karzai. The fear that Washington was prepared to sell out to ISI, or was too naive to see that it was being had, is a major factor driving the Afghan government's precipitous efforts to find a line to talk with the Taliban or a separate deal with Pasha and Kayani. Afghans believe that if their country is to be sold to Pakistan, they would prefer to bargain over the price directly rather than rely on an agent, meaning the United States, Rubin wrote. One Saturday late that winter of 2010, Richard Holbrook met a reporter privately for lunch at the Four Seasons Hotel in Georgetown. The dining room was almost empty. Holbrook juggled a cell phone and a BlackBerry restlessly. Before he even looked at a menu, he admitted that he wasn't at all sure that the Afghan war would succeed. The military clears areas out, but if they can't transfer security and governance to civilians, it won't matter, he said. McChrystal doesn't know if it will work, and neither do I. Petraeus is the best four-star general I've ever seen, but he's spinning all the time. Unlike David Petraeus, I'm willing to tell you that I don't know if it's going to work or not, and neither does Stan McChrystal or Carl Eikenberry or Hillary Clinton, or, I think, the president. There's a very clear definition of midterm success, he continued, and that is a policy that allows our combat troops to start leaving in the summer of next year at a pace and a size and configuration to be determined, but which, when it occurs, does not collapse the country. That's what Nixon and Kissinger and Abrams tried to do in Vietnam. They called it Vietnamization. We have avoided the word Afghanization because it didn't feel right and would evoke Vietnam, which people hate, by the way. But they should be less scared of history. He was feeling his way toward a negotiation with the Taliban. Mullah Muhammad Omar had defended his ties to al-Qaeda at every critical moment, even though it cost him the Islamic Emirate in 2001. I think Mullah Omar is incredibly important, Holbrook said. The more I look at this thing, the more I think he is a driving, inspirational force whose capture or elimination would have a material effect. That's why I think eliminating Mullah Omar is so critical. Right now, if you could choose between Mullah Omar and Osama bin Laden, I personally would lean toward Mullah Omar. Do you assume that ISI could deliver Mullah Omar if they wished to do so? I don't know. If I had an answer to that, I would act on it. Holbrook continued, There are three countries here, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India, with vastly different stages of political, social, and economic development. They share a common strategic space. As has happened so many times in history, the weak state is the one that sucks in the others. That's the history of Afghanistan, and now the great game is being played with different players. The India-Pakistan relationship is an absolutely critical driver. Holbrook was preparing a secret memo for Hillary Clinton, which he would deliver in about 2 weeks. The draft had a despairing tone. He wrote it under the slightly anachronistic heading, Private and Most Confidential. The title was, How Does This Thing End? In Search of a Policy. It began, Since last August, I have been trying, unsuccessfully, to get a serious and sustained process in the interagency on policy toward what we call, somewhat euphemistically, reconciliation, by which we really mean contacts with the Taliban. We cannot defer this issue any longer. Based on his extensive discussions with Petraeus, McChrystal, Mullen, and Gates, as well as private comments from senior White House officials, I believe it is quite likely that there will be significant differences of opinion within the executive branch and even inside the military on these issues. The differences can be ironed out, but only with the president's personal involvement. He went on to inventory the disagreements. His memo surveyed the under-examined assumptions of the Obama administration's expeditionary war. Premise 1. The war will not end in a pure military victory. Everyone says they agree with this premise. But upon closer examination, even this truism produces some disagreement. For Petraeus, it means that the war will follow the Iraq model, a slow reduction of violence as reintegration works its way upward. David does not foresee, and so far opposes, any real discussion with the leadership of the Taliban. He feels it would show weakness, might, if and when it became public, demoralize people, and would be unnecessary. He appears to believe completely that the current offensive will succeed to such a degree that the enemy will simply switch sides in increasing numbers, as they did in Iraq. Of course, we all know where Hamid Karzai stands on the issue. He simply does not believe our counterinsurgency policy will succeed, hence his constant outreach, in private and public, to the enemy. Issue 1. What is an acceptable and achievable end state for the U.S.? It is a difficult question, fraught with strategic, political, and even moral implications. Our stated goal is to destroy al-Qaeda. Suppose we were to achieve just that. Would we then leave Afghanistan once again, or simply remove our combat forces? In the end, there is this. Even if the Taliban maintains a very hard-line position, the American public and our allies will not accept an open-ended commitment that involves continual combat and casualties. Nor is it likely the Afghan people will either. Most Afghans may not want the Taliban to return, but there is an old adage. If the guerrillas do not lose, they ultimately win. Premise 2. Whatever else is decided, we should maximize our military pressure. This is a fundamental point, although often disputed by well-intentioned but misguided members of the European and American left. The chances of success of any reintegration or reconciliation policy will be significantly increased by battlefield success. But Karzai's support for this is less clear. His constant public requests for an end to night raids, an end to all Afghans held by the United States, and his vocal public exploitation of the civilian casualties issue are all warning signs that he might turn on us one day if it would help him negotiate a deal. Premise 3. Timing is critically important. Integrating the military and diplomatic track is essential for success. Nixon and Kissinger encountered this problem and were defeated by it. When they began negotiating with Hanoi in 1969, there were 550,000 American troops in Vietnam, but under domestic pressure, Nixon unilaterally drew down to about 135,000, while Kissinger negotiated for almost 5 years. By the time they cut the final deal in later 1973, the two men were like the losers in a strip poker game, naked. They had no chips, or clothes, left with which to bargain. The result was a communist takeover of our South Vietnamese ally less than 2 years later. Roughly the same thing happened to the Soviets in Afghanistan, without even the negotiating. This argues for a simple proposition. If we are going to explore the options for any sort of settlement, it should be done while U.S. troop levels are increasing, not flat or declining. It was Holbrook at his strongest, at once an outsider and an insider in his thinking, bold and clarifying. The problem was, within the Obama administration, beyond Hillary Clinton, he had lost his audience. The president could not abide Holbrook's mannerisms and undisguised ambition and tried to avoid meeting him. In January 2010, Obama instructed Jones to suggest to Clinton that it was time for Holbrook to depart. Holbrook's relations with the ambassadors in Kabul, Islamabad, and New Delhi had deteriorated. The election fiasco with Karzai lingered. Holbrook was in regular conflict with Doug Loot at the NSC. They shared skepticism about the military surge in Afghanistan, but disagreed about how to pursue diplomacy. Holbrook wanted to talk to the Taliban himself, but Loot argued that they needed a non-American in the lead. He suggested Lakhdar Brahimi, the Algerian-born diplomat and troubleshooter. In any event, Clinton was unwilling to fire Holbrook, and she had enough influence with Obama to prevail. The result, however, was less a team of rivals than a system of parallel policies and priorities running on diverse premises. As diplomatic and intelligence reporting about Karzai's unmoored musings and flirtations with ISI came in, the White House recognized it had to make an effort to reel Afghanistan's president back. British intelligence officials warned American counterparts that the Pakistanis are confident in their strategy, and at the same time, confused about what the United States wants. There was a reason, as Holbrook had outlined in his memo. The administration remained divided and in search of a policy that could produce an acceptable outcome. The U.S. government seems utterly focused on secondary or trivial issues, Rubin wrote to Holbrook on April 13th, and remains virtually clueless about and unengaged with the rapid and deep political shifts taking place in the region. These included the degradation of the U.S.-Afghanistan bilateral relationship, as well as the perception that the U.S. and NATO are on a fast glide path out of the region, while the Pakistan military displayed increased confidence and assertiveness. Kayani sought a separate understanding with Karzai, but he also wanted to explore whether it might be possible to change Pakistan's relationship with the United States. Early that year, National Security Advisor Jim Jones flew to Islamabad to meet with the Army Chief. Kayani handed him a 106-page document describing Pakistan's views on a range of issues. The document came to be known at the National Security Council as Kayani 1.0. When intelligence and State Department analysts pored over it, they noticed that it seemed to have been drafted by the Pakistani Foreign Office and contained a lot of familiar boilerplate. It described five key areas of Pakistani security interests: nuclear deterrence, Kashmir, access to water, the future of Afghanistan, and the search for a non-hegemonic South Asia, meaning one in which India had less influence. Islamic extremism wasn't on the list. From his reading of the paper and his discussions with Kayani, Holbrook boiled down the position of ISI and the Army. They believe the United States wants to take away Pakistan's nuclear weapons. They see the Afghan National Army and NDS as pro-Indian forces commanded by the remnants of the Northern Alliance. They want the U.S. to mediate on Kashmir. It would take a great deal of effort to change that mindset. Jones and Doug Loot worked on a plan to invite Karzai to Washington. In mid-March, Obama and Karzai held their first secure video teleconference in months. It seemed plain that an enormous effort would be required to break the alienation between the White House and the Arg Palace. In a gesture of respect, Obama would fly to Kabul to formalize the state visit invitation to Karzai in person. The president landed at Bagram on March 28th, just over 2 weeks after Karzai returned from Islamabad. Wearing a flight jacket, Obama flew by helicopter to the Arg, where Karzai received him upstairs. They spoke one-on-one, and then joined a table of Karzai's cabinet members and advisers. Obama's message to Karzai, the Afghan cabinet, and American troops he addressed was one of unwavering commitment. "The United States does not quit once it starts on something," he said. "We keep at it. We persevere. And together with our partners, we will prevail. I am absolutely confident of that." Each Afghan minister said a few words to Obama. When Amrullah Saleh's turn came, he spoke bluntly. He wanted to be sure Obama heard what he believed to be the unvarnished truth. "Pakistanis believe the West has lost the war against the Taliban already," Saleh said. "The Pakistani view is that it is just a matter of time before the United States and Europe acknowledge their defeat. The West, on the other hand, thinks that Pakistan is losing because its economy is weak, it can't produce enough energy to light its houses and factories, and its politicians are corrupt and ineffectual. But that is not how they see it," Saleh insisted. "They see you are losing. They see division between Europe and the United States. They see these mild approaches to talk to the Taliban." He continued, "We have to change their perception to say, we have not lost, and you are too weak to defeat us. If we do not do that, we lose. We lose to whom? Al-Qaeda, Pakistan, Taliban. It is our joint mission. We don't need to complement each other every day. This effort needs such intense cooperation. And remember, a failure here means some time of trouble in more than 60 countries as extremist movements find space for revival." Obama listened, stone-faced. He said nothing in reply. Amrullah Saleh understood that he was working on borrowed time as the NDS director. For one thing, he had a reliable sense of what Karzai was discussing with Pasha, even when Saleh wasn't present. He had been head of NDS for 6 years. He had survived many iterations of palace intrigue. He had the CIA's confidence, but to many of Karzai's aides and Pashtun allies, he remained a symbol of undue Panjshiri influence over the government. He was well aware that his removal from office would please Kayani and Pasha at a time when Karzai was exploring a new framework of partnership with Pakistan. The NDS's tree-shaded compound in downtown Kabul had been renovated since 2004 by infusions of CIA and European budgetary support, but it lacked the high sheen and washed marble look of the ISI's new headquarters in Islamabad. Saleh furnished a musty room just off the main entrance to receive foreign visitors. He remained clean-shaven and typically wore a dark suit. He was a hard man and oversaw a network of prisons and interrogation centers where torture and brutality remained common, according to human rights groups. Saleh knew that talking to the Taliban about peace was in the air. Barnett Rubin had discussed the project with him. He opposed such talks because they would inevitably empower ISI. He felt that Karzai was pursuing not a national agenda, but a Pashtun ethnic agenda, evident by the president's regular remarks in private along the lines that the Taliban were his cousins and that we can't keep fighting them forever. The Taliban, all of a sudden, once again, have become the bargaining tool for the Pakistanis, he told an international visitor during this period. Talks with the Taliban, in the eyes of ISI, must be under the control of the Pakistani military. Regardless of how much we kill the outer circle of Taliban soldiers or influence the middle circle of Taliban commanders, They can create massive numbers of infiltrators from our refugee population in Pakistan, train them again, send them back to fight in Afghanistan. And they will keep the Taliban leadership hibernating somewhere in Pakistani territory with some degree of deniability. In Saleh's analysis, the strategy of ISI and Kayani was now to help NATO leave Afghanistan with dignity, preserving as much stability and access to Western finance and defense supplies for Pakistan as possible, before ISI again asserted political control over Afghanistan. The Obama administration could reach out to the Taliban all it wished. Its grasp of its enemy would prove elusive. "They are masters of this," Saleh said, referring to the ISI and the Pakistan Army. "They developed their nuclear bomb under the watchful eyes and smelling nose of the West. Keeping 25 guys roaming around Quetta is far easier than developing a nuclear bomb. The West has to ask itself, how many times in its history with Pakistan have they been deceived?" Chapter 24. The Conflict Resolution Cell. During the first months of 2010, the Obama administration pursued three strategies in Afghanistan and Pakistan. From ISAF headquarters, Stanley McChrystal commanded an intensifying ground war based on the clear, hold, build, transfer principles of counterinsurgency. His campaign plan posited that the Afghan war could be handed off successfully to Afghans, even if the problem of Taliban sanctuaries in Pakistan was not addressed. From the Global Response Center in Langley, the CIA independently ran a secret drone air war against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban holed up in Waziristan. The rate of strikes reached an unprecedented tempo during 2010, about two per week. Simultaneously, from the ground floor of the State Department, Richard Holbrooke and his aides, who were largely shut out of the first two lines of war strategy, pursued a third, trying to talk to Mullah Mohammed Omar's lieutenants about peace. Holbrooke's team also moved to persuade Kayani and Pasha to abandon Pakistan's historic pursuit of influence in Afghanistan through the promotion of violent Islamists. On paper, Obama's National Security Council supported all three policies. But it would require feats of mental gymnastics to call these lines of action synchronized. That spring, under the rubric of strategic dialogue, Holbrooke showed Kayani and Pasha around Washington and tried to give them the intimate, high-level attention afforded to leaders of Britain or France or China. Flags and flowers by day, fireside chats by night. The more Kayani and Pasha felt welcome to informal conversation with high-level American counterparts at Blair House, the guest home across from the White House, or at Admiral Mullen's residence, the more likely the generals were to finally move past the stiff formulations of the Kayani 1.0 white paper and towards some honest discussion of the ISI's tangled relationship with the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Afghanistan's violence. At least, this was the theory. Holbrooke and Mullen also encouraged Kayani to repair ISI's battered image in Washington by talking more openly about how Pakistani soldiers and spies had suffered their own casualties from terrorist and insurgent attacks inside Pakistan, particularly since 2007. "Tell your story," the Americans urged Kayani. It was not his strong suit, but he agreed. Black suburban SUVs with red police lights on the dashboards whisked the Army chief down L Street one weekday morning in late March. Kayani traveled with a minimum of aides. He gripped a laptop containing a PowerPoint slide deck. At a think tank where he was to present, he ducked into the stairwell for a cigarette. He was wearing his Army greens, but he wished to appear on stage in civilian clothes, so he stripped to his undershirt in a conference room, pulled on and half-buttoned up a dress shirt, and then ducked out for another smoke. A few minutes later, his eyes dark and hooded, and his hair lightly combed, Kayani sat folded up in an armchair before a crowd of former American policymakers, journalists, and intelligence analysts. He spoke in sentence fragments, barely